All right, we're live.
Yay.
Well, hello. Welcome to Smart People, Dumb Brains, episode 5. Mm. Awesome. The last time that we were here, we were talking about human trafficking, and we talked about the offender side of it, very kind of basic information. And today we want to focus on the victim side or the survivor side of all of that.
Yeah. And, you know, if you hadn't listened to the other one yet, we're trying to, like, this has been something that's really been in the news. And a lot of misinformation on both ends of, like, you know, sort of the, you know, this is everywhere all the time side of it, versus, like, this isn't nearly as bad as everyone's making it out to be, versus us who live this in our work and know it's far more common than people realize, but also trying to, a lot of the weirder conspiracy, like, because, you know, I'm not saying that conspiracies around this don't exist, because obviously they do, but, like, sort of that weirder shit, and trying to kind of myth bust some of that stuff, but mostly just speaking to our experiences as practitioners who work with individuals who have been victimized. And then Brenda, you specifically also work with offenders. Brenda has if you don't know who we are, Brenda has a separate license. Besides being an LPC, she's also a licensed sex offender treatment provider. And she is certified in working specifically with trafficking. This is, you know, very literally her sandbox. And so we thought it would be helpful for people who are like, what is true and all this media that I'm seeing, you know, from the point of view who are the people that are treating this. Might be helpful.
Yeah.
You know, and even I think last time too, we were talking about some of the things that we're just hearing about in our own community, that some people are like, what do you mean, like tunnels under houses and stuff? And, you know, that there is some of that stuff going on from what our clients and stuff reporting. You know, we're not saying this is like the factual news-based thing, but, you know, these are things that we consistently hear from the individuals that we work with.
It's a very lucrative, organized crime.
Mm-hmm.
When we think, if we put it in that context, you can begin to like really think about drug dealers as well. And drug dealers also engage in sexual human trafficking. So there is money in it, billions of dollars. And so they will do what they need to do in order to not get caught and to continue to be able to exploit women and children, young boys as well. Anybody they can, they will exploit in some form or another, whether it's sexually, whether it's through labor, whether it's, you know, the debt, exploitation, any way that they can, these people will absolutely exploit whomever or whatever. And as human beings, I think I said this last time, we're reusable. And it sounds, even to me when I heard that, you know, in that context, like we're reusable. You know, for sexual trafficking, that person as a commodity is reusable. It's not like, I don't even want to equate it to anything else because I don't, you know, it's.
Well, any kind of resource that is something that you can sell a bag of cocaine, and once it is taken in the system, that's it. That's the end of the cocaine, and people can be used and used and used and used.
So all of it is so much, and I share with Faith kind of all the time, like it is so much that, you know, we cannot possibly talk about every little thing within the hour that we do the podcast. And so just kind of giving general information so that people can kind of really understand or begin to understand like what it really looks like. Like, what does it really look like when we read headlines? And me and, you know, Faith will share with me headlines about, you know, there was recently, I think it was 25 kids out of Ohio, you know, there was 150 kids, you know, who were found who were being trafficked. And so what does that really look like? And what do those children and or victims really experience in this lifestyle? Because it's horrendous.
And I think that probably a lot of people that are listening to this saw that they had an estate. They did just a one day roundup of there were these missing kids. Let's see how many we can find. Like literally, like they spent a couple of weeks preparing for it and they did some one day roundup and they found so many kids. And I think that that's helpful to see that this is bigger than people have been aware of. And we tend to have this extremist view of like, oh, that rarely happens, or, you know, it's like this whole crazy QAnon thing. And there is space in the middle to understand that it is far bigger than we've been aware. And not everything that looks like a conspiracy is completely crazy. There is a middle truth, and we need to be, you know, sort of looking at that information with open minds on either end, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
In what the reality is versus what either we're just perceiving to be real, right?
Yeah. Those kind of numbers of like how many kids were found in one day, I think is a really interesting way of recognize when we say that we're seeing these things and, you know, talking about, you know, tunnels under houses and stuff, like there's probably a whole lot of truth to what is being reported to us as therapists. If this is then what is happening in follow-up when they're finding missing kids. Yeah.
I think that, you know, when we think about trafficking and in our other segment, we had talked a little bit about the different pimps and kind of how they function. There is a misconception, I think, that some prostitution, like when you talk about the sex workers, the consensual sex workers, mm-hmm. There's a lot of muddling in who is being trafficked and being prostituted versus who are really those consensual sex workers who are empowered in that. Mm-hmm. And so I have heard even therapists talk about, well, it's consensual. And so it's very disheartening that there's a lot of information out there, and there's a lot of different viewpoints about what it really is. So, I mean, I think it's an interesting topic. I always love what I do, and I love talking about it. And I was laughing, you know, when you were talking about me being an LSOTP, I was kind of like, damn, like, this bitch in her LSOTP, like, who fucking cares, right? Because I'm always talking about it, right? But the education that I get from it is so incredibly interesting, you know, because we were talking about trafficking several years ago. 4 or 5 years ago, I had created like a kind of like a little curriculum or something to get together to help some of the people who had been trafficked, but then who had also become leadership in that organization. So they were also now grooming and other victims, right? Mm-hmm. And so there wasn't a whole lot of stuff out there 4 or 5 years ago. There was some stuff. Traffic 911 was one of a really big help. So we were seeing it kind of in the shadows, I think, mm-hmm. being criminalized much more than they were being seen as victims. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I really kind of found out about it back then, you know. And so of course that kind of stuff, that exposure for me always makes me interested about kind of going deeper. So
yeah. And I remember when you were working on that and how you were having such a hard time finding stuff, and now it's becoming like we were having a conversation. And I mean, I was lying in bed with the cats. You were probably doing the same thing in her own separate bed with her own separate cats. And I'm just like pulling up like data points, and we're just like shooting each other texts that even a few years ago, we never would have found that data that easily. Yeah. So that speaks well. So even when we get into these really weirder and wilder theories, at least it's bringing stuff to the forefront. And I'm saying like being cautious and being paying attention in the middle space is there was a woman who got very concerned about trafficking just right up the road from us in Waco and decided to go look out like and do this vigilante justice against traffickers. Did you see that? Yeah. And was like trying to take a kid away from their own mom, you know, like just kind of had a break. And so like, you know, holding space in the middle, not everything is trafficking, but there's a lot more going on than we were talking about even a few years ago. And, you know, being open-minded to that middle space.
Yeah. I think that lends to really, if we work in the field, we really need to have the training. Right? Mm-hmm. really have to understand what our role is versus what are the police roles and those nonprofits that really are kind of doing the groundwork, right? Like really going to the airports, really going on the streets to really kind of give them resources so that they kind of understand that there is an out, as difficult as that may be sometimes. But we each have a role in this very multi-systematic team framework. I don't even know what else to say. I think of it a wraparound. I always think about it. There's a team, there's teams out there who can really help get them hopefully off of the streets. And then we want to build, of course, stabilization. And then what does that mean? Mm-hmm. So being able to help them feel safe, right? I mean, we are not the primary workers with the traffickers. You know, we are, they're going to see police first. They're going to see those nonprofit organizations first. They're going to be fairly stabilized. They're going to be given some kind of housing. And then we kind of come in a little bit later and try to do the work. And mm-hmm. I think training and understanding what our role is incredibly important in any of the work that we do with this kind of population.
And I think with trauma work in general, or any kind of special population versus, you know, like, you know, working with stress and anxiety, or, you know, kind of whatever the more general stuff that we're trained in, is we can be very, very affirming to someone's experience and have so much empathy and want to support them, but that doesn't make us competent. Yeah. This is something I see over and over and over, and that's okay. There are things that, like, you know, again, working with an offender, and I've had some experiences, particularly in community mental health, of, you know, working with people who had offended. But if somebody's really needing to do that deep work on their accountability of their offense, they need to see data, not face. That, like, I can be accepting of their work and really grateful that they're wanting to do the work and be a good member of the community, but that doesn't make me competent in that work. And I, you know, Brenda and I have, anyone who works in this field has had an experience where somebody had some kind of microaggression perpetuated upon them by a clinician who was very affirming, but really not competent. And so we need to, like, for those of you who work in the field, is we need to sort of be continually assessing of making sure that, you know, if we're wanting to do this work, that we're getting a lot of training and not just like, okay, I did that 25-hour certification, I'm good to go, but continuously training. Brenda and I are the two original geek girls, and that we're sort of continuously training and continue, you know, and like, okay, so I need to know more about XYZ. I don't know enough about that. And so I need to send them to this, and I need to learn more about this. And, you know, being in that, okay, we're not expected to know everything and be competent about everything, and you can be affirming and kind and make sure and do a warm handoff to the correct person or whatever. So, I mean, for those of you who are interested in the work, like, this is a good starting point. There's so much good training out there. You know, you got to think about, like, what end do you want to work with offenders? Do you want to work with victims? Do you want to work with both? Do you want to be involved in the court system and being doing court testimony, which is something else you do? Or I was a court liaison for many years, and I do not want to go back to the courthouse. So I actively avoid that at this point in my career. So thinking about what you want to do and building a practice around that and being super clear. So yeah, I get people all the time saying, hey, I need a court assessment. And I'm like, super not your person. And, you know, and having really good parameters in that regard. So we don't do more harm in the work that they're doing, especially like they've become safe with us, you know, we're very affirming, they're feeling very heard, and then in some way we do harm because we're not competent.
Yeah. I mean, and part of that competence is, it's just so much, is really kind of understanding, I think, that criminal element and the dynamics of that, mm-hmm. And really understanding that as, and this is the hard part, because I think with some people who are kind of victims and survivors, they don't really consider themselves a victim, right? Because especially when we talk about those Romeo pimps, where they think that they are in love and they are in a long-term relationship with that person, mm-hmm. they don't consider themselves a victim. And so really understanding the dynamics of that organization and how they manipulate and brainwash the victims into really taking on responsibility for part, and then become also offending in that organization as well, right? Like grooming the other, you know, other victims and or children.
And understanding, like, if we take that away from them, what do we just do to their psyche? If we said, no, you were raped, you know, and if it was done in that kind of blunt way, what do we just do to their psyche versus having them, you know, come to that realization of the long-term manipulation that that occurred. Yeah.
And so, you know, part of that competence, I think, for me is really understanding that criminal element, because I think that for people who, and even aside from people who have been trafficked, I mean, even people who are maybe homeless, like what kind of criminal and deviant thinking are they engaging in order to survive?
Survive, right.
So we are going to look at someone who's been trafficked, and it's a very similar dynamic in that they are surviving these experiences. And what does that mean? And so surviving means we might have to engage in criminal behavior, stealing money, all kinds of different things. In addition to experiencing the trauma of being trafficked. And so I always think like it's a mind fuck, right? Because it's like, I'm in love with this person if that's the case, or if I have been literally kidnapped, you know, within 24 hours, we know that they are going to be severely beaten or severely raped. You know, it is about that. And what does that do to a person in living in the context of that lifestyle? And so competency definitely for me is about, you have to be able to understand that.
The complexity of it.
You're going to have a client who may potentially be resistant, not necessarily because they just don't think they're a victim, but also because they're stuck in this activated state. Mm-hmm. So even though you're a professional, even though you're trying to tell me that this is true, that brainwashing that happens and that physiological response of being talked to in a certain way and how we understand triggers now and the tone that we're using, the environment that we're in, how that keeps them resistant, even if they are in a fairly safe place. Right. So even if they're in housing now, even though they don't have contact, it becomes that dynamic that as clinicians, I think we have to like really kind of maneuver in a very sensitive way, but also to also help them be directive. So that's how I am. I mean, I think we and you are both pretty directive.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I say, like, directive isn't mean.
Yeah, sure.
And I, you know, people, and because I've also, you know, I've seen clinicians that are directive in a way that I thought was too rough and too activating, like too pushy, and it caused more issues. So we're not saying that, like, no, we're going to do this, and you just need to stay in it, and I don't care that you're crying. But it is, I said, it's the difference between kind and nice. Is usually what I tell people. I'm like, I'm not nice, you know, we're going to work, but I'm kind, you know, and there's a difference there. We're going to make sure that you don't leave with your entrails hanging out. We're going to get you re-ground. You know, what you said, like you can be in a place where you're out of that situation and you're physically safe, but your body doesn't know that, your amygdala doesn't know that yet. And right there, safety is the treatment. Right. So you need to be able to come in this room and to be able to connect to somebody's calm nervous system so you can modulate your own. And that may be a whole bunch of your treatment for a while. And so we're still doing work there, and we're not going to push you into a trauma narrative and have you collapse. Once your brain and body also understand that you're safe, then we may be doing some more work. But it's not like a niceness. It's not like, oh, poor baby, pat, let you off the hook. But it's also not mean and pushy. Because you probably have too. I have people come in just like they're determined, like, we're going to do this trauma work. And I'm like, hey, I want you to have good skills first. So we're going to do some skill building on that first. And they're like, no. And then they go, and all of a sudden they're super activated there in the room. And I'm like, okay, so we need to get your your nervous system back re-regulated. So stop talking, and I'm going to teach you a grounding, you know, and having to go back to that. And that stuff's really important too. So that's why it's there. We're going to work. Therapy's not rent a friend, but all the work will be done with kindness, and you're not going to leave ripped open. We will always take the time to make sure. So where are you now? Do we need to do something to get you re-regulated? You seem to be, you know, having a hard time staying in your body right now. Let's go ahead and take that back down and get you back in your body. You know, like all that stuff then becomes a part of that. And it's directive, but it's not unkind.
Right. Yeah. I like to think of it as a compassionate directiveness.
Yeah.
Because I'm so aware of the environment. And I think being aware of the environment, and I talk about micro expressions, you know, really understanding what somebody's body is doing and being really attuned to that for our clients is really important. And that takes time, right? It takes time to kind of develop that and to kind of really understand what some of that looks like. So it is a directiveness, but I think it's very compassionate in that I'm kind of really understanding the emotional room that I have to challenge a little bit. And when I say it though, like I just kind of like being like, oh, I'm real directive and I'm on it, so whatever, right? But in session, it's also, it's very, very different, right? And so we talk about,
we're just going hard. We're going to chingona this. Well, and I mean, like the example you gave of a micro expression, like directive would be like, well, that pissed you off. You know, kind and compassionate would be like, well, you just had a really big response right there. Or did something that I say upset you? You know, and that's very direct, but still very kind. And it's leaving room for interpretation. It's not telling people how they feel, but it's still calling out what you see, you know? So when we're saying directive, that's kind of what we mean. And any of my clients will tell you like, yeah, I don't get away with shit, but she's never mean.
I would hope clients don't think I'm they keep coming back. So
I mean, and it depends too. Some people, like, especially my people who are in 12-step recovery, they like me to call it out. I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? And they're like, I know. It's like, everybody has a different personality.
So I think that's important, right? The competency part is really important. And I think really understanding, someone's body, like a polyvagal stuff, is going to be super important. I, in my own training, learned about, let's see if I get the name right because I never remember. It is psychogenic, non-epileptic, and PNES, non-epileptic seizures.
Yeah.
So those
are the body releasing those charges. Yeah.
So it's like a seizure, but it is not a traditional seizure. So I've actually experienced that. And it is a little bit discombobulating because you think the person is having a seizure if you're not experienced in it. And it looks very much like a seizure. I've seen people have seizures too, but they're not in it. And they kind of take their time coming back, and they can come back, but it's, you know, all you can do is make sure that they're going to be safe the way that we would do for somebody who's having a seizure, right? You want to make sure they're supported on the side. You want to make sure they're falling off the couch or the chair. And so that's something important to know too. If you're working this kind of trauma where your client is going to be highly disassociative, that their capacity to handle stress puts them in a position where they're having these psychogenic non-epileptic seizures, you do have to have that competency, right? You have to know, like, how to address all of those kinds of things. So it's really, really interesting. I think through the polyvagal stuff, I also learned that when we're activated, let's see if I get this word too. You might know this, when the bones in your ears open when we've been activated so that we can hear better. For people who have kind of chronic trauma, kind of like a trafficked person or a victim of, they stay open because they're constantly being activated, right? They're constantly having to assess danger. They're physiologically having that response all the time. And so they stay open. So they might always be irritable, right? They might come in and they're always like, ugh. You know, you have that stupid noise machine out, which some people will talk about, like, oh, it's so annoying, like, I can't stand it, or the lights are super bright, which can be activating for some people. And so really understanding what your environment looks like too. Like that's important, understanding what your client is experiencing, potentially experiencing, is also important. So understanding if they're talking about sound, that might be one of those issues that they might be having, and helping them to, and educating them. I always think of with my clients, because I kind of work under the umbrella of recovery, I always tell my clients, like, it's my job to help you feel empowered in your own life. Like, whatever that means, right? Mm-hmm. Is I'm going to educate you about everything I possibly can about how trauma impacts us as human beings, so that you can be empowered and feel in control of your own life. And it's the same thing with working with these kinds of survivors, is we want them to feel empowered and be educated, so that they can then can also advocate for themselves, right? So if they hear about, oh, this noise thing, and, you know, I'm always hearing a ringing in my ear, you know, it's just agitating because things are too loud, then they can begin to advocate for themselves within their own, the doctor work, that, like the real physical doctory stuff that they're going to be doing. And so they can advocate for themselves. But if we're not aware of those things, and we just see our client as defensive and resistant and projecting, we're going to feel some sort of way about it.
Yeah.
And because we're human, I mean, we might be therapists, but we're also human beings, and we might feel some sort of way and potentially be harmful. So it is important to understand, like, the very nature of the impact of trauma, but then also the trauma of being a survivor, you know, because the things that they experience, I think, are, I guess, for, I mean, just horrendous. I don't know what else word to use, you know, when in all the different trainings that I do, you know, we hear about a lot of different things, and, you know, they're being branded. I think one of the bigger things that I hear about is the tattoos, you know, that their pimp will tattoo them, but what we don't realize is that they're also being branded. They're also being sexually tortured, right? They're also having any kind of finances pulled from them. If they have children, they're having their children pulled from them. The pimps and the organized criminals that are kind of running this will do anything to maintain that commodity, right? And mm-hmm. I put quotes because it's, you know, it's very abrasive to my ears, so I can't imagine to others, but to the victim, right? Mm-hmm. So they'll be doing these very horrendous things to the victims. And the impact is they have to survive it. They have to endure it. And if they ever come out of the lifestyle, then they have to deal with the long-term impact of all of those things, right? So talking about our ears being messed up, we're talking about now having branding and having to, or tattoos and having to see that all the time. The psychological warfare that really happens with that, like the brainwashing, you know, in addition to the shame of engaging in some form of sexual contact with multiple people every single day, with the fear of losing a child, their life, because they weren't able to meet whatever kind of quota they were being given, which is always different too. You know, I think that if you're working on the higher end, whether you're working kind of on the streets, there's going to be different kinds of expectations from pimps. And so, you know, that too, you have to take into consideration, like, what does even that mean? You know, some of these victims are being forcefully drugged, right? They become addicts in this process. And so in their recovery, now they have to work that. You know, and so all of it really is, you know, when I think about it, it's just a mindfuck. Like, every part of that human being has been violated.
Dehumanized. Yeah.
Yeah. And so understanding all that part, understanding the medical conditions that can come with it, you know, so there's the ear issue. So I might be grumpy because things are so loud, or the noise machine. But then if I have chronic pain, you know, if I've had multiple STIs, if I have HIV, you know, if I have hepatitis C now, I mean, that long-term medical impact too, and how that's going to disrupt my own recovery here psychologically. All of those things are really important to be able to recognize. In addition to, I think, us understanding in the recovery field is that it takes 2 to 5 years to really get stable. So that's long term, right? Mm-hmm. You know, these organizations that are coming in how long are they really helping these people, right? The survivors, are they coming in and helping for 6 months, for a year? But then they're kind of left on their own, knowing that they've lost family because maybe they haven't had contact with family, and they don't want to have contact because of the shame connected to it. They don't, may not have a good support system. They don't know how to trust. Like, there's all of these things that, at least in my mind, I'm like, we have to be able to consider when we're really working with this population. And then you have the other dynamic of if you were trafficked by a family member. So that's also a different kind of dynamic, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're being kidnapped or Romeo, you know, gets a hold of you and you're pimped by your Romeo, it's very different than being trafficked by a family member. You know, I know that there was an article, I think Vice did it, and they were talking about how this lady in the Philippines was trafficking her infant children. You know, that leads us to this idea of sex tourism, right? Mm-hmm. People are going into these countries and engaging in sex tourism and essentially getting away with it, right? Mm-hmm. And then they come back here and act like things are normal. And so it's, I think the depth is there, like it's so much. So, I mean, I think it does go back to that competency. It's a lot. It's a lot.
Yeah. And I mean, like you said, you know, not to scare anyone away from doing the work, because we need people that are embracing that work, but realizing that the learning process is continuous, and we're having to think about things from all different angles. Like you said, if, you know, what happens if they fall out or the noise is really bad? And those are things that we've had to think about and set up our office. Like my, you know, my coffee table rolls out and there's a very soft rug underneath it. I have the bone conducting headphones and the Bioworld Beats if they need something that's soothing. You know, like everything, as you learn about it, you're like, okay, so what could I offer that would be helpful? And that becomes a continuous part of the process of therapy, is, you know, having those sort of somatic things that can help them manage their own nervous systems so they can do the other work. Because if they can't be safe here, if safety is the work, if that's 90% of the work, then we're never going to get to the other 10% if they don't feel safe.
So, you know, the competency of just understanding all of that, and I think all that's just front end work. That's just all the understanding before somebody even sits in my office. Mm-hmm. Because now you have this human being in my office, and how do I help them? And so definitely understanding what safety means. Mm-hmm. Me personally, I tend to ask a lot of questions because I don't want to make any assumptions. So it's like, are you comfortable here? What about this? What about that? Mm-hmm. As a way to help them feel a little bit more in control, especially mm-hmm. when I first meet people. Because I want them, because we talk about really tough stuff. And so I don't want them to feel like, oh, well, this couch is too hard, or I'd rather sit over there on the floor, or I'd want to sit in your chair, right? Because I have a chair and, mm-hmm. and this is my long couch. But like, whatever it is, like, cool, like, let's do it. Like, whatever mm-hmm. works for you. Like, that's the first part of allowing them to feel some sense of control in this environment that really isn't theirs, but is mm-hmm. for them. So it's so much to consider when we're doing the work. But I think that, you know, the first part is that safety. That's mm-hmm. it, right? They feel safe enough to even say, I'm having a hard day today, right? Mm-hmm. To us, seems like nothing.
Yeah.
Seems like nothing. But for someone who has been brutally beaten for not having a smiling face on a video, you know, or someone who is being accused of stealing, whatever it could possibly be that is horrendous, that is incredibly challenging. Mm-hmm. And helping them to see that, like, that's big. Wow. Like, yeah. Like, tell me a little bit more about that, so that, again, they can kind of drive it a little bit. And, you know, I always believe it's our job to empower and educate. And so being able to incorporate an intervention to kind of help them feel empowered in that response, and talking about, you know, the physiological responses and, you know, thinking errors. Like for me, that's all my basic stuff when I do trauma work. Because it's empowering. It helps them understand, like, holy shit, I was doing that because of that. Like, yeah, like, wow, right? Like, you had to survive all this time and you stopped breathing, right? So part of that not breathing was you were, like, having to hide somewhere. And so you would stop breathing, and that's that. I mean, it could be anything. It's, you know, I just cry, but I don't, like, sob. I'm just, tears are just running down my eyes. Well, I mean, those are all purposeful reactions to what's happening within your body, within your mind. So, I mean, I think it's great work, but it's also, you got to be confident. I don't think I can say that enough.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and the ethical implications of it, if you're not competent, right? And if we do harm, and liabilities, like, so there's all of these, not just are we sitting in front of this client and understanding the dynamics of the criminal element of it, understanding the trauma element, we're also having to understand the liabilities that come along with doing this kind of work, and how easily it would be to be harmful. So it's a great, for me, it's a great field of work, and I like working in the field. But it is a lot, and it does require, like, a lot of different trainings to try to be as helpful as possible, I think, is the best way I can say that.
I think just understanding the complexity of the trauma response for somebody who had this very systematic form of trauma that was designed specifically to break them. And sometimes from a very young age, and sometimes from the primary caregiver, and those kinds of things, that helps us understand, like, obviously this would be complex. You're not just going to teach them, oh, well, you need to understand automatic thoughts and core beliefs. It's not going to be enough. And when you understand, like, how complex the trauma is, and for those of you listening who have been through similar traumas, you can imagine how complex your responses are because of that. And you need somebody that can follow you and provide safety and scaffolding for you in that process. You know, I've had people who cannot be on the couch, and they come in and they lie on my floor, and I sit down on the floor, you know, like the kind of those kinds of things that we need to be able to pivot and do, and understanding that if something's if the problem is complex, the solution is also going to be complex.
Yeah, for sure.
And so I get, you know, and I get mad at this, like, oh, I can fix anything in, you know, 8 hypnotherapy sessions. And I'm like, really? Well, then you must be amazing, because I cannot.
Yeah.
Which is a snotty answer, but yeah.
Yeah. So being able to work trauma, I think definitely is good to know just in general. And I think we all are at this point. I think trauma-informed care is so, I can't say shoved down our throat. It was very different when I started. I actually sought out trauma work because I knew for sure that was the field that I wanted to go into. And I was in 2008 was when the TFCBT stuff came out. And I had even emailed, gosh, what was her name? I don't remember now. Whoever one of the developers' name was.
We did our training with Susanna.
I think it was
that was when the state actually said we're going to invest in trauma informed care.
I did it before granted.
And then we did the one with Susanna Rivera, who's amazing.
Yeah.
And that was close to 10 years ago.
I had actually emailed one of the developers, and I was telling her about this. And so she helped me frame it, I think, in a better way. But that's how new it was. Well, even me, as I think I was a practicum student at the time, was able to reach out to her and then really kind of gather more information from her, understand it.
Like, my master's program did not have a trauma course. The closest I had is I took a class that was not even core curriculum. It was called Counseling Addicted and Violent Families. It was only offered once. Like, and that's exactly the kind of courses we need to be having. But of course, it was only offered once, and it was not core curriculum. And that was probably the closest I came to actually getting it. So, you know, we both came up at a time where that wasn't standard and we had to seek it out. Like, I don't think this is schizophrenia. I think this is trauma. Like, I don't think this doesn't seem to make sense to me. I'm seeing trauma. And having to seek that out. And then when we were together at the Center for Healthcare Services some time ago, the state was kind of recognizing the same thing. And the two of us were able to get a lot of training that was granted through HHSC. Yeah. So we were in the right place at the right time and got really lucky in that regard and have continued to pursue it. But there are definitely options out there now for people who want to get started. And you may do some trainings and go, not for me. And that's also fine. There's trainings that I've done that I've liked certain parts of and, you know, had some issues with other parts of for, you know, whatever reason, usually because I don't think they're treating trauma effectively. And so you take what's useful and you dump the rest is also okay. Or just saying like, I really just don't like that intervention. That's just not me as a clinician. Like that doesn't attach to my worldview. And if that's true, then I'm not going to do it very well. Is also okay.
Yeah, definitely.
We both had trainings where we came back and went, no.
Yeah. I think, anyway, so that's a whole different topic. But I think that happens a lot. And I don't know if it's because I have extensive training. I think a lot of different like trauma stuff. I tell my partner like, oh, I'm like a therapist snob. You know, because I'll do a training and I'll be like, what the fuck is this? Like, this is like real basic information and I'm paying for it. I want like I already know all this stuff. I want like advanced training. So I'm like, I'm a therapist now. Like, oh, I am.
And I get really picky about good trainers and we'll follow them to the end of the earth for that reason. Like, if I think somebody's really amazing and, you know, they're in their 70s and they've been doing it forever and they go deep, like, I will, like, where are you? You're in Colorado? I'm on my way. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, but you know, this kind of work is just so tough. And it, aside from the competency and the knowing the dynamics, and you also, I think, as a therapist, really have to be settled in. I don't know how to say it. Maybe you can say it better for me, but to be really settled in who you are as a therapist, who you are as, not just as a therapist, but I think as like personally, mm-hmm. you know, so that you're not taking some of the stuff that you hear either to heart or take it personal in an offensive way, because some people are really rough. I mean, they just really are. You know, I've been cussed out multiple times, you know, for, you know, just like because they're responding to whatever that's not really anything about me. Or I think many years ago, and I don't know where I heard it. When I was in, I think in my master's program at the beginning, I worked with a supervisor at the only adolescent female sex offender program in the U.S. And so I was in training and she had told me two things. She's like, never let them know what you feel and don't ever cry. And so I was so new to it. I was barely going into my master's program. So I didn't really understand that. But being in the field and working with, I think, trauma survivors, I actually had survivors tell me, like, you know, my last therapist used to cry with me. And how that impacted them. They're like, well, fuck, now I have to take care of my therapist. Right? Because then they become these kind of caregivers in their own trauma. We know it like now is fawning, right? But they had to become this kind of caregiver. Now they feel obligated to care for their therapist. So that clicked for me when she told me, like, don't ever let them see you cry. Because all of the children in that unit had also been sexually abused. You know, so we're looking at this continuum of, you know, victims becoming offenders, which we see in trafficking too, you know. And yeah. So allowing them the space to own what is theirs. Like, it's not mine, but it's theirs and they can own it and they can really begin to feel that and process through it. And I can sit and be with them in a compassionate, present way without feeling the need to you know, and I don't know if people feel the need to cry with them or they're just so empathetic that they just kind of start crying. But the impact, again, like, it's that kind of thing that I think about, like, harm. Like, if my client has to take care of me, am I doing harm? I'm just perpetuating the cycle that they were already living. And is it going to be effective long-term then?
And we can show the empathy and the connection and the engagement and the compassion without making, you know, the difference there is, like, did we just make it about us instead of their experience? So again, if we're going to safety is the treatment, we have to have a regulated nervous system so they can co-regulate. And if we're sobbing, we don't have a regulated nervous system, you know? So like, even as a supervisor, I'm teaching tricks to, how do you stay empathic and stay engaged but not absorb it? Yeah. And, you know, I've had clients tell me, I could tell by your face you really understood. Like, it wasn't a coldness, but it was they needed to be able to co-regulate. And if I'm so upset for them, they can no longer do that because I can't give it. Yeah. And so that, you know, and so what Brenda's talking about there is exactly that. Like, if you're so upset by what they're saying, then you can no longer provide the safe nervous system that they need. But you can still show, I'm hearing you, I'm feeling this with you, I see you, you know, and that you don't even necessarily have to do that with words. I've had people tell me a lot, they can tell by my face I'm there. And that's plenty. And, you know, it's just like, because I'm relationally trained, I, you know, so the relationship with my clients is the treatment, which means, you know, I was trained in this, like, you don't ever talk about anything. And RCT says, well, that's obviously not true because we grow in relationships. So how do you model an appropriate one? How do you model appropriate boundaries? What do you share and why? So if somebody goes, oh, my mom's a fucking bitch, I can be like, oh my God, girl, mine too. Do you know what she did? Or I can go, oh my God, we have the same mom. What's up? You know, and I can make that connection without then making it my story, where they can be like, okay, cool. So I can talk about, you know, there's that, who's benefiting from how I'm sharing my experience right now. And, you know, going back to, they can't regulate unless you're regulated is, I think, probably always going to be rule number one.
I remember, I mean, I think that because I have a resting bitch face, and I'm a little bit mean, and I think because of the LSOTP, it makes me very directive. When we were at CHDS, I was always kind of given the tougher kids. And I remember, you know, one of the kids was kind of going off, and I'm just sitting there, like, I'm just like letting him do his thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And I reached for the phone. He's like, oh, you're going to call the police too. And I was like, no, I'm not. I want to get you some water. And it's that. It's like he has this assumption that he's going to be criminalized like he had been in the past. Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking, like, no, I really want you to be comfortable. Like, I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
Tell me whatever else you want to tell me. But it didn't touch me because I understood from when my old supervisor over in Kentucky said, don't let them know what you think, right? Mm-hmm. And so inside, I think, of course, I'm like, oh, like, I don't know what to do. Like, this kid is kind of off. But externally, I mean, I'm just kind of like, man, tell me more, right?
Yeah.
So it's about also honoring that. Like, we, as human beings, we have feelings too when we hear stuff. But being able to
really— And they need a safe place for that. I think I told you, like, we had, there was, in the building that we're in, there was the corporate offices for a local restaurant chain. And my husband and I were at the restaurant, and the guy that worked at the corporate office was like, oh my God, yeah, you're in the ELSA building. He's like, man, I used to stay late because I'd hear people yelling, and I was always so worried about you. And my husband's like, you have people screaming at you? I'm like, they're not screaming at me. They're screaming. Like, I was not unsafe. But, like, it was so sweet. Like, sometimes it would get so loud, he could hear it over the noise machines and stuff, this incoherent. And I do have all people standing up, and they're yelling, and they're a spittle and all this stuff. And okay. So I can tell all of this stuff is going on. Is this how you are with your partner? Because, you know, I understand that you're in pain and you're not scaring me, but then we can have a conversation. Does this scare other people? You know, and then when we're really seeing what's going on, and then we're showing them that I can be a good container for that, but then they need to learn to contain that. And then they can look at how might this affect other people. Because I can say, like, you know, I don't think that you'd hurt a fly, but you're big and you're loud. And I wonder how other people feel about that when you get big and loud. And they can go, that's fair. Like, because I just took it, right? You know, I just heard it and I didn't react with fear to where they could get defensive, and that changes the dynamic. If we're just letting them have an experience and we're saying, okay, now let's talk about that, that changes the dynamic so it doesn't become an attack defense situation with one more person.
Yeah, so definitely being able to like own our own stuff is incredibly important. So, you know, I've had clients cuss me out. It's just like, okay, well, you know, tell me what that means, you know. And then they can really kind of have a conversation about it. It's kind of, they get it out. There's that big bleh, and they can begin to kind of de-escalate, because I'm like, I'm not running away. I'm not going off on them. I'm just kind of like, okay, you know, like, well, what does that mean? And just gathering more information from them, that helps to kind of de-escalate that. But I mean, understanding that some of our clients who have been trafficked are going to have that kind of response, right? Because that's not only what they've learned, but it's also that physiological response of like, oh, you're challenging me now, right? And so if we're challenged, what does that really mean? That means that I have to maintain power here if I'm, you know, the middle person and grooming the younger or new victims that are coming in. And so being able to really own that for ourselves, being able to sit in that discomfort, because I think when it first happens, it is very uncomfortable. And I think even as a human being, I think I still have a physiological response to it, but in my own recovery and in, you know, learning how to do all of this, it's like, okay, yeah, like that would bother anybody, right? Like human being, part of the human species, like that would be hurtful to anybody, but I know that's not about me. That's about what's happening here in this room and what's going on with that person.
That doesn't feel good, but I can stay in my prefrontal cortex and I can maintain space for this right now. And then I'm probably going to need a nap later, but that's okay. Or some chocolate or something. But,
I mean, so I think...
So we're not saying don't yell at us because you can get away with it.
Right.
We're saying if you're yelling... You know, we're going to hold space for that. But like you talked about, like, it's a very physiological thing. The fight, flight, freeze response. I think people don't understand that the fight is not about a getting over. It's not a coercive control kind of screaming that we're talking about. We're talking about fight in that sense is a survival skill. I'm fighting to survive. I'm not fighting to win. So I see that this is a person fighting to survive. This isn't about trying... It's not a coercive control thing with me. When we have somebody who's just like that, it's a fighting to survive. And once they see like they're okay and that peters out, then we can have a different conversation.
Yeah, sure. So it's all like crazy interesting. I love it. I love all of the work that I do, and it's very specific. Like I love, like one of the experiences that I have, like I think that I've been in recovery for so long, it's been like over 20 years, that I think I can manage those kind of physiological things, like when I'm being yelled at, you know, and wherever, because I'm not, unfortunately, just yelled at here, but you know, in the community, if you're yelled at, people are like flipping you off, whatever it is, you know, being able to manage that has been so instrumental for me, because I used to be on the other end. So I used to be the person like flipping people off and being purposely aggressive. And so then having to learn how to manage all that and being able to do it in such a way that is still compassionate and still ready to listen is incredibly important for, I think, our clients in this field. And I think even working with like the offending population, you know, they too, you know, use those kind of tactics, what I call tactics, because it's purposeful behavior. It's intentional. It's to get people to back off. And so, of course, our guys and the survivors are going to use that to survive, to get people to back off, right? Because it's uncomfortable. So being able to own it, I think, is such a wonderful thing. And I always encourage people, like, that's yours. Yeah. So, you know, I have And sometimes I see clients who want to be therapists and stuff. And so I always tell them that, like, well, you got to get your shit together then. Like, get it together. Because I can tell you, as somebody who's been in recovery and as a therapist, is it'll touch you. It's going to touch you if you don't work on it. And so I always encourage people, like, just work on your own shit. You know, like, it's okay. Like, we've all got our own shit.
Yeah, you can't just, like, and we know plenty of people that are became therapists and because they're hiding from their own shit. And we're saying that as people who are sort of continuously in therapy and continuously doing our work, and I send my interns to therapy, like, you need to have that continuous process for yourself if you're going to be healthy. There are some fucked up therapists out there that are not wanting to deal with their shit, so they're getting all up in yours, you know.
Yeah.
And it can be just like, you know, with my therapist, I'm just like, is my reaction here, right? And, you know, and even if you're like, is my reaction here, like, is this fucked up? And no, girl, that's normal. Okay, just checking. Like, just being able to have that touchstone of somebody who knows you to check in on stuff. Like, I'm really frustrated about this, and I want to make sure that I'm handling this well. Like, I'm trying to stay in my moral alignment here, and this is super activating for me. You know, in supervision too. Like, I think that, you know, I'm really, like, reacting poorly to this client. You know, and I remember having a supervisor like, well, the client's being a dick. Of course you are. I'm like, okay. So I'm not just, like, having my mom shit come up or whatever. You know, that kind of, you know, having supervision, having consultation, and having your own therapy is important.
That's always important.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I'm really honest about it with my clients too. I want them to know you're not the only one doing your work in the room. I promise. So.
Definitely. You know, I think that's why I've always sought out consultation groups, because I'm just like, man, this stuff is hard. And I mean, I need people to kind of check me, to make sure that I'm not, you know, I am very big about accountability. So I always want to make sure that other people are, like, you know, keeping, so I'll text you and be like, oh my God, blah, 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 you know, like, what, you know, what do we do here? Because I just want to make sure that I'm not being harmful. That's such a big thing for me. And always engaging with consent. That's also a really big thing for me. So, you know, always having to make sure that I'm not, in my own very subtle way, covert way sometimes, you know, am I doing that because I think we need to work on this, you know, trying to get them to this topic because I think that would be important for them. Allowing them enough room to be able to work on the things that they need to work on or want to work on, but also being directive and kind of guiding so that they're not just flip-flopping in, like, their own, you know, recovery.
We're not just doing the cow stuff, being crisis of the week, that there's trajectory. Yes.
Yeah.
And, like you say too, like, and so for those of you who are like, what do y'all do for consultation, is, like, Brenda and I really pushed ourselves really hard. And, you know, before the world shut down, we were pushing through and doing, well, some really complex work on edge states and those kinds of things, of, you know, trying to take on where does it become what we're trying to do, like, move into maybe being toxic instead of helpful, and really kind of exploring those big gray areas is a lot of, like, the kind of, like, the consultation stuff we've done in the most recent, you know, recent times.
Most recent, 6 months ago.
Before Rona's, yes. You know, doing, like, you know, trying to do really deeper and thoughtful work.
Yeah. That was incredible stuff. I actually really liked that.
And she and I, we went to a day retreat at a Zen Buddhism center that neither one of us belonged to, because there was some really deep ideas that we wanted to carry into practice that, that Brenda and my husband and I do, just to have that experience and carry it into our, you know, that challenge of, you know, sort of Buddhism, or the Buddha being the first psychologist, what can we take from this Zen Buddhism practice and carry forward into clinical? And so we kind of, not just going to regular training, but you know, trying to grow people and stuff in that process as well.
You're like, yeah. I agree.
So we were going to talk about victims, but we were mostly talking about, like, don't fuck them up more and being today's topic.
That's important. So, that's important.
That's important. And, you know, and if you're somebody that's listening to this because you're just kind of interested in the work and you're not a clinician yourself, this may help you realize, like, oh, I went to that therapist who was, like, really nice, but I didn't really get too far. maybe that's not my fault. Maybe they didn't have the capacity to do that, but they were very kind and very affirming and I liked them, but the work didn't get done. You know, as I say, that you didn't fail therapy, therapy failed you at that point.
Yeah.
And then maybe you're willing to try again with somebody who, you know, works more deeply in that area.
Yeah. I mean, and I get some of those clients too, like, oh, I did all of this work, but it didn't really go anywhere. And that's, I mean, that's always interesting too. Cause I think everybody works like me and it kind of puts it in my, not everybody works like me, you know?
People. Yeah.
I always joke because it used to be true, but people are so much nicer than me. I mean, I think I haven't always been this nice. But that, you know, other therapists are just kind of really nice and affirming and, you know, warm. And I'm just kind of like, what? You know, like, no, let's not do that, right? Just more directive and in still a compassionate way, but
yeah.
So I get some of those clients, right, who were like, well, I did this therapy and I didn't really get anywhere. And so that's always interesting to me. But I think that it's very important for us to, I guess we didn't really, we did talk about the victims and like the different experiences that they have and some of the impact that we.
And why it's big and complex and all those things.
But it's so much, like there's no possible way we could do this whole thing in like literally probably what's coming up is an hour. There's no way, it's just so much. It's just
well, honestly, like this is why I'm writing books, you know, the Unfuck Your Brain was really about what's going on in the brain and I'm working on connecting that to the whole somatic body response and the vagal nerve and inflammation and the stress response and all those things and bringing in, because I couldn't put it all even in one book. It's its own separate book. There is a lot there for, and there is so much more out there now. Like even when we started, you and I in the field, the vagal nerve was something that was being studied in the 90s as maybe an efficacious way of keeping neonatal babies alive, like understanding like the physiological response in a trauma. We didn't know that. Like that literally, that research didn't exist yet. So if people are like, shit, I didn't know that. Well, there's a reason. It's new. And we're learning more every day.
Yeah. I mean, and it's just so much, really. You know, I know when we've talked about like doing some of this, I'm like, it's just so much. Like, where do we even really start? Because it's just so much. Like, you know, when we started doing this, we were talking about we're going to do offenders, we're going to do victims, then we're talking about the legislature. But at the end of the day, like, it is so much that it can be something that is like for my training was 25 hours, you know. Mm-hmm. So it can be that, because it can be very detailed in terms of like what you can learn in this very specific field, right? Mm-hmm. So not even counting like the offender work that I do, and then just kind of looking at, I mean, we do trauma work in this field too, but kind of working more general trauma, like it's, so it's just so much information to learn and to, in order to be competent and to be able to do it well and not do harm, at least, at the very least, not do harm.
Yeah. Well, and even if you're just somebody that's trying to get a handle on, we're talking about trafficking all of a sudden, what's up with that? What do I believe in there? Sort of embracing the complexity of, this is big, this is something that people don't know much about, and there's a lot of complexity to however we're experiencing this, you know, as a clinician, as someone who's in treatment, or as somebody who's just, you know, a member of society who wants to understand this better. I like, the more that we can understand that this is very complex and not oversimplified stuff for our own comfort, the better. Leaning into the discomfort of the complexity is important. And anyone who's like, y'all gave me a headache, you know, that it's not a bad thing to go, I'm recognizing that there was so much here.
Yeah. It's kind of just,
and that's okay. And so to be reading things, you know, with that eye, like there's a lot more here than this one little article on Yahoo News. Yeah. There's a lot more. Like, I can go down that rabbit hole, but I can also just be a really conscious consumer of what I'm seeing and recognizing that there's going to probably be more depth to than just what somebody tweeted.
So, how about we stop here?
Sounds good. Because I have to go potty anyway.
Okay. I guess next time we'll have to come up with a topic. Unless you want to do the legislature stuff.
Yeah, we can talk about that a little bit, or we can come up with somebody else. We'll just leave it open. So anybody who's like following along and is curious what we're going to talk about next, we don't fucking know.
Yeah. Guess what?
Yeah.
You won't know till you see it.
We may be talking about gummy bears. I don't even know.
Alrighty. Well, thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope it gives you a little bit of insight into the complexity of like the work that we're really doing and the things that are really important when we are on this side of the couch, right? So if there's people listening who are not therapists, on this side of the couch, we are very aware that there needs to be a lot of training, that we're keeping an eyeball on a lot of different things. And so we always want to be helpful and not harmful. So as for therapists, I hope you learned something, especially if you're not working in this kind of field. And if you are and you learn something, you know, get training. So, alrighty. Bye.